For WTOP News, it's the Book Report. I'm Tariq King. Medgar Evers was an American civil rights activist and the NAACP's first field secretary in Mississippi. Medgar Evers was also the first civil rights leader of his era to fall to an assassin's bullet in June of 1963, leaving behind his wife and three small children to chart their way forward on a path that no one had traveled before them. And now a new book from a renowned journalist tells the historical and personal story of Medgar Evers and the family he left behind. I'm pleased to welcome host of MSNBC's The Readout and author of Medgar and Merle, Medgar Evers and the Love Story That Awakened America, Joy Reid, to The Book Report. Thank you so much, Joy, for being with us today.
Hey, Tariq. It's great to be here.
As a journalist and as the host of a national news program, you receive a steady diet of national stories, local stories, and the day's news. And so of all the stories you could have chosen to devote a book to, what compelled you to choose this one?
Well, I would say what compelled me was really not a what, it was a who. It was Merle Evers Williams herself. She's such a compelling figure. And if you spend 10 minutes with her and she starts talking about Medgar, you would want to write two or three books about it, because she still exemplifies this, you know, sense of being just giddy in love with this man. And it was such a compelling story that she told me back in 2018 when I got the chance to meet her when I was doing my weekend show and she was a guest on the show. We just got into this conversation, and that conversation just stayed with me for years, literally, because it was just such a deep love and it was still so present for her that when it came time to think about what I wanted to write about, I thought, you know what, this will be a joy to write about.
So, of course, it's a riveting historical narrative, but at the heart of this book, you emphasize is a love story. Tell us who Medgar and Merle were as people.
They were both Black folks from Mississippi, really regular Black folks from Mississippi in many ways, both from rural parts of Mississippi. He was from Decatur, which is a segregated town in the rural part of the state. And he grew up in this kind of unusual family. His father was the kind of Black man who didn't really bow to white people, which could actually get you lynched in the state of Mississippi at that time. But he was so bold that the white folks just thought he was crazy. They used to call him Crazy Jim. His name was James, but they called him Crazy Jim because he was so bold with white folks. But he also was very realistic. You know, when Medgar and his older brother Charles saw their first lynching and witnessed the aftermath of it when Medgar was 11 years old, he asked his father, could they do that to you? And even his big, bold daddy said, oh, yeah, absolutely. They could do that to me anytime. So they were realistic, pragmatic people, but they also ordered the Chicago Defender to make sure their kids had positive images of Black folks. So that was his family. Merle grew up in Vicksburg, which is also rural, also segregated. But her grandmother and her aunt who raised her, and the aunt's name is also Merle, they instilled in her a kind of more peaceful, dignified kind of version of the fight. You know, they understood there was racism and segregation, but they raised her to have high standards, to have high expectations. She played the piano. She did piano lessons, and they would hype her up and say, you know what, you're so great at playing the piano, you could play Carnegie Hall in New York one day. And so they really raised her to think positively about the world, even in their circumstances of being, you know, teachers, educators, but not rich folk, really kind of poor folk, but with a lot of kind of quiet dignity. So they were two very different people in terms of their temperament. But one thing they definitely agreed on is that they loved each other.
There were two really significant aspects to Medgar's story, along with his father's influence, but also two very important formative experiences, I think, that set him on his trajectory before he met her, his military experience, and then his experience with voting or attempting to vote as a veteran. So tell us just a little bit about who that made him by the time he even met Merle.
So I would say besides his father, you know, Medgar Evers' biggest influence was his older brother, Charles. He just revered him. You know, they slept in the same bed. They were from a blended family, so they had half sisters and half brothers, but they were full brothers and just as tight as they could be. So when Charles went off to World War II, Medgar followed him. You know, as he turned his 18th birthday, he signed up to volunteer to fight in World War II. He was on Omaha Beach at D-Day as part of the Red Ball Express, which was this segregated unit of Black Transportation Corps. And he comes home and he and Charles decide they have fought and risked their lives for this country and they wanted to vote.
For many of us who've gone overseas, fought for this country, fought for Mississippi, we fought for Alabama, we fought for North Carolina, we fought for Illinois, and we fought for every state in this union.
And so they head off in 1946 to try to register to vote and are turned away by 200 armed white men who say that's not happening today. Now, after that standoff in which both of these two men were armed as well, these brothers, because they were not about that nonviolent life. They were about that got to do what you got to do kind of life. And they wound up being able to register, but not able to vote in that election. But that didn't stop them. They decided that this was something they were determined to do. And that actually set Medgar Evers on this course of really believing that the right to vote, the right to dignity, the right to live as free men was something he had earned as a veteran, as somebody who had fought for this country. And that really did inform his, and actually a lot of Black folks at that time, their fight for freedom and liberty.
And so when he met Merle, he was in his early 20s and she was, what, just under 20, right?
Yeah, he was 25 and she was 17. So he definitely understood that there was an age and a stature difference. And that's why their relationship when it first started was more of an intellectual romance than a physical romance because she was so young. They met on both of their first day at Alcorn State College, is now Alcorn State University. She was a feisty sister, you know, and they had a contentious relationship because she did not agree with the idea that he would go beyond being an insurance salesman, which is the job he got when he graduated, to also selling civil rights. She knew that the things that he was doing, trying to convince people to register to vote, could get him killed. And so she really didn't agree. And she was not shy about saying that to him. So when he becomes the very first field secretary for the NAACP, it increases the tension between them. And she was very open about it. And so that was a lot of the book, is talking about this very real relationship that they had that was love, tension, arguments, the whole nine, everything that goes with a real marriage.
And that is the core of the story. Like, it's this man with a mission, a devotion to this mission, and his wife who's trying to support him against her own fears while keeping her family safe. Even in 1963, when he presented this petition to desegregate schools, he wanted to put his children as part of the petition. And she was, of course, against that, but she had to push past those fears for this sort of higher calling. So, you know, and these are all things that are very personal, but the story is set against what I have to describe as just a really magnificently researched historical backdrop of the struggle for desegregation in Mississippi.
Thank you.
The things that you mentioned, yeah, it really great work of just a brilliant, magnificent work of research. So the question for me, how long did it take? While you're managing the show and everything else, did it take to do this research?
This was a 2-year project. It took about 2 years to pull everything together. For the first time, I did something very un-Gen X. I actually hired 2 research assistants because normally I do it all a bit myself for doing my previous books. And I love research. And we spent a lot of time, myself, my assistant, who actually is an amateur genealogist. She loves genealogy. So she and I and our team of 2 researchers from Howard University, you know, we had to go and get the Howard folks. And we just went, we dove into the archives. The Evers family were very generous in letting us just go into their archives and just go through them. And obviously, Merle Evers Williams had a lot to do with the research that she'd done herself. She wrote 2 incredible biographies. She also, with Manning Marable, compiled Medgar's papers. And so we had that as well. And then I got my Library of Congress card and just went in and got in the stacks. And then they would just bring me all the stacks of stuff. And I'm going through papers and rifling through the NAACP's historical archives and letters. I really enjoyed it. You know, it was like a deep dive. I really felt like I got to know these people in addition to doing lots of interviews. We kind of camped out in Jackson, Mississippi and interviewed the neighbors, the friends, the people who live next door and across the street and the people who were the kids down the street who are now adults. And we talked to everyone that we could get our hands on and talk with. I talked with Bernice King and she gave me stories that connected her mom with Miss Merle. It was really it was a wonderful process. It was an exhausting process. But yeah, it was a good 2 years of work in order to get this book together.
What most people might not know about you, they may know that you graduated from Harvard, but they may not know that you graduated from Harvard with a concentration in film studies, right?
Yes, I did. Yep.
So, you know, as I'm thinking as you're saying that you went out and you interviewed the neighbors on the block who heard the shots, and it really added to the visceralness of the narrative, right? But I'm going, well, if she's like me, who loves to make a good documentary, Did she bring a camera?
Do you know we did.
A documentary? You did. Okay.
Yes, we did. So we ended up, and it's interesting, one of the reasons that, you know, my husband runs a production company, and so he came along with us. And so we all went, it was like six of us who all went down there with our friend Joe, who's our longtime camera guy. And so we went down and we said, well, let's just document these interviews, because most of the people we're interviewing are elders. You know, the one lady, Miss Joe, who lived across the street, has already gone and passed. And so we said, if for nothing else, we want the oral histories to remain, the sights and sounds of these incredible people. We wanted to document it. And we didn't do it for the purposes of doing a documentary. We just figured, let's just go ahead and get it on tape. So all the interviews that we did in Jackson are videotaped interviews. And once we got these pieces done, we realized this is a documentary. Like, there's a lot more here to do. So we have all of this incredible footage. And then we are actually working now with this company called the Documentary Group on a documentary film specifically about the assassination. Because one of the things that we learned is that almost no one in Jackson who was alive at that time believes that Byron D. LeBeckwith acted alone in killing Medgar Evers. Most people believe that there was some kind of a conspiracy. I mean, there was a state spying agency operating at the time. There was the White Citizens Councils plus the Klan. And the family and others believe there was more to it. So that is one of the projects that we are working on that will be a next step, is to do something in the documentary space on the assassination of this man.
You write pretty vividly about his murder from Murley's point of view on June 12, 1963. And I'd like you to connect for our audience, if you could connect the dots about her interaction with President Kennedy afterward, which set things in motion that I say bore the fruit of the Civil Rights Act, even after Kennedy was assassinated. I just thought it was a stunning sequence of events. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. If you go through Medgar's papers and his letters, whether it's at the Library of Congress or in the family archives, a lot of what he was doing was writing to John F. Kennedy and to Robert Kennedy and imploring them to send federal troops to Mississippi, to send observers to Mississippi, to do something about the fact that he, as a person whose job it was to register people to vote, Black folks to vote, couldn't do it because the people there were too terrorized to register to vote. They knew they could be lynched or have their mortgage pulled or be evicted just for registering to vote or joining the NAACP. And his insistence included, you know, signing up to go and testify before the House Judiciary Committee demanding a Civil Rights Act be passed. And so his interactions with Kennedy were direct. And Kennedy ultimately responded, not directly to him while he was alive, but when he died, President Kennedy wrote a very personal letter to Murley Evers Williams because he understood the connection between the assassination and the speech he'd given just hours before, where he finally promised, yes, he was going to do a Civil Rights Act. And this was after meeting with the NAACP, including Medgar, who was in this big room with all these civil rights leaders, where Kennedy said, I'm going to do this. He announces it, and then early the next morning, just after midnight, Medgar is assassinated. And that was a message from the Klan very directly. And I think Kennedy understood that. And he sends not just a letter, but he sends for Murley and her children. And he greets them in the White House, along with Charles Evers, Medgar's older brother. And he hands Murley a copy of the bill. And he says, I'm going to send this bill to Congress. And then when it takes too long, the March on Washington is a response to it taking too long to get that bill through Congress because Kennedy gets distracted and starts trying to do a tax cut. So the connection between Medgar Evers and the Civil Rights Act that we're going to celebrate the Jubilee year for this July is direct. It's not indirect. It's literal and direct.
Why do you think it's important, particularly now, that people keep Medgar and Murley's story front of mind?
To make it real when we say to young people, people died for your right to vote. This allows us to be much more specific. I mean, Medgar Evers literally died for our right to vote. You know, that sacrifice is not ancient. It's literally just a generation ago. But I wanted this to also be something else. You know, I wanted it to be a love story as well, because while these heroic figures in our past did heroic things and often lost their lives for it, In addition to that, they did things like fall in love, have kids, have to make sure the kids had lunch, lunch boxes packed, you know, went on dates, danced with their sweetheart to, you know, their favorite songs in the living room, playing the records. And Medgar and Merle did all of those things too. You know, they had a romance in addition to trauma. And I wanted to make sure that the full story of them was told, not just the sad parts, but the glad parts and the beautiful parts. And the loving parts. And so I wanted to make sure that this man, who I think is a legend and should be, his name should be known like Martin and Malcolm, that he was also a human being and an ordinary person. And it's inspiring to me to know what ordinary people can do when they love someone or something enough to act.
And I understand you'll be at Politics and Prose on Monday the 26th, correct?
I will. Politics and Prose on Monday the 26th. We will be at Enoch Pratt Library on Saturday. And so we're just going to keep it rolling. And then we'll be in the following Saturday in New Orleans, one of my favorite cities in the world. We're going to hit everything. We're just going to go everywhere with this wonderful story.
All right, Joy Ree. Well, tell it loud, tell it proud, tell it everywhere. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with me on the Book Report today. An absolute honor.
Thank you, Tariq. I appreciate you. And I love the hat, man. I love it.
I do what I can. And I thank everyone for listening to this edition of The Book Report. For WTOP News, I'm Tariq King.